Pod. 22 Red Pod. In the city that sounds nice.
Huh. How are you doing? You all right?
Well, to be honest, and quite appropriately, I'm a little bit hungover. For the era, you know.
Yeah, me too, actually. I'm on like my second day hangover from Tuesday, so it's all very fitting.
Yeah, okay. I'm on, I just think with the, this is going to date your podcast episode immediately, but just with the second lockdown and the US election and various other things, it's kind of, yeah, feels like a stressful time for a lot of people. So I responded as I do in staying up too late and drinking too much wine.
Starting point, I usually like, well, we usually ask, you know, how you first started the band and all that, but I noticed on your Wikipedia that it said Dids made his trade as a stand-up comedian in Reading before music. Is that any truth in that?
Well, I wouldn't want to get in the way of a good story. I like to know, it's that's, I don't know who put that there. It's just something that's on the Wikipedia page. I did certainly haven't had anything to do with that, but I like it. You know, there's, it's, I like the idea of people having rumours and urban myths around themselves. And if that's mine, then I'm quite happy with it.
Well, we had Ronnie Joyce on who said he quite liked trolling your Wikipedia, apparently.
Is that right?
Said he used to put something about you having the biggest collection of Blockbuster videos on there or something.
Yeah, I remember that being on there, but I didn't know it was him. God, it sounds like I fucking look at my Wikipedia page every 20 minutes.
You sat there Googling yourself, aren't
you? Yeah, constantly. That's that. Yeah, drinking wine, staying up too late and updating my own Wikipedia page.
Same here.
Good.
Yeah, I suppose if we do move on to that first proper question, then like looking back at the Cooper Temple Clause, yeah. Can you give us an idea of how you started that band and then went on to getting on a record label and stuff?
I can give you a very good idea of it. Yeah, we all went to the same school. Four of the band were in the year above me, and John was the year or 2 years above them. And they had, before they'd been playing, the four of them have been playing together since they were, I don't know, year 7, 12 or whatever, and just knocking about in various forms and to varying degrees of seriousness. But then by the time I got to them, they had a little industrial unit that they turned into a sort of practice room, a little PA, some amps, some drums. And were starting to think about doing proper gigs, but they didn't have a bass player, so, you know, or a proper drummer. I stepped in and I was sort of quite impressed with how good they were and how imaginative the songwriting was. I'd been in bands before, but it hadn't been as creative. It had been more meat and potatoes, that kind of, this is like, 98, I think we're talking now. And I think, you know, I always say that, you know, I was by far the least talented member of the band, but I had the biggest gob and kind of the best sense about things, and you know, that's what kind of made it work. They were, you know, it certainly wasn't me, the musical genius. There were a couple of musical geniuses in that band, and it wasn't me.
Didn't you introduce him to the haircut as well?
No, that's not true. that's not true. Tom, the haircut was... there was a guy in Reading...
Did he work at Tony and Guy?
No, he didn't. He worked at HMV, which is why it was called HMV Bob. But he had this kind of, you know, fate. He had this amazing faces, these animal men, kind of haircut, very, very sort of mid to late 90s. And he had this band called Magpie. I'm not sure they ever did a gig. And I got to know, I didn't really know him, but I've worked with him in HMV a bit. But so he was kind of the idea, he was kind of the base, not the basis of the haircut, because it wasn't the Cooper Temple Clause haircut. It was just like this mod look. But we wanted to look like we were from the 70s and flares and tight T-shirts and kind of big hair. And I think later on, we did kind of we did get into a really weird marketing thing between us and the enemy and Tony and Guy, and it was a competition to win a Cooper Temple Claus haircut and stuff, and there were the there were the stickers on the given away with the, on the cover of the enemy of just our hair, like it
was yeah, I remember it. Don't get me wrong, I was a massive fan, and I definitely copied your haircut for a bit anyway, so cheers for that. I remember that. I remember them stickers coming out in the enemy though. I must have bought that copy.
That was when I had the asymmetric fringe.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Yeah. So, so we were getting together, and they were pretty good, just getting off the hair for a minute. And we did a few gigs, and we decided to get into London, and we play on the Camden circuit, as it was at the time. This is before East London was the thing that it came to be, really. But so it was still for bands. It was still about Camden. There was still the Falcon and the what was the Barfly, but at the time I can't remember what it was called at the time. That's criminal. But the Bull and Gate was the main one for us. And we played there loads of times. We had, and we just happened to have a couple of people see us and stick with us and eventually sign us. I mean, it was, but Nick Raymond was the guy, RCA, that signed us, but the courtship was quite long. It was about 18 months, like, of him kind of giving us money to demo tracks and be quite frank and brutal with the criticism, and just getting us up to a level where we were, you know, legit. So that was kind of how it worked. Yeah,
moving into that first album in 2002, so it's produced by a guy called Paul Corkett, and he's produced The Cure and Placebo before that. Was that kind of that kind of encouraged you to work with him after working with those bands?
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember why. We met a few producers. We met, we'd worked with a guy called Neil McClellan on the first record, and on the first EP, and he kind of set up the session. We met with him, and we liked him because he worked with, I think the band, I can't remember what the band were called, but it was something to do with The Prodigy, and they were quite sort of, they were good, they were like strong electronic kind of dance elements to them, but they were a guitar band, and we liked Neil. And then we set up a recording session to do this EP, and he sort of like showed up once and never came back in the 2 weeks. So he was out. And then we met with, what's the guy, he produced the Stone Roses first record, John Leckie, and we liked him. We met a few other people. What we'd do, because we were based at this sort of industrial unit in the middle of the country on a pig farm that stank, what we'd kind of do almost as a test was to drag people out there. So when we had like record labels, when we were sort of doing the dance with the record labels and publishers and like these fucking, I don't know, John Leckie, like Uber producer, Radiohead, Stone Roses, Simple Minds, whatever, Pink Floyd, The Beatles, we'd drag them out to, you know, the middle of this stinking field. And we quite enjoyed that. But yeah, I don't really know how we ended up with Paul. He was, I don't know. I mean, I don't think we really knew too much about The Cure at the time or anything else. I think we met him and we sort of quite liked him, and we had a session with him where he came down to the studio and sort of suggested changes and stuff, and we kind of just, I suppose, we just clicked to a certain extent. And that was that.
And it's obviously quite a lengthy album. I think it's 80 minutes long.
Isn't it?
It's also, yeah, according to Spotify, it is, yeah. It's quite varied in styles and influences. Like the song 555-4823 is like almost a bit drum and bass. Was it? Did you have like a strong idea of the music you wanted to make early on?
Yeah, I was going through. It's not that funny. I was going through the tracks the other day with Tom, actually, and not you, Tom, my Tom. And I realised that it was. I remembered that it was originally called Temple Fex, like Cooper Temple, a Fex twin. That was its working title. And it was very, it was pretty deliberate. I mean, the whole idea of the band, we were looking at Primal Scream and the Super Furry Animals and Radiohead and a few others, not even as a real stylistic reference, but in terms of, we wanted to do loads of different kinds of music. We wanted that album to almost sound like a mixtape. And, you know, I had an idea at one point that we'd get 10 different producers on it and, you know, make each track completely different. And that didn't happen and it wouldn't have worked. But that, to illustrate the point, that was the point. So with 555, 4823, you know, we, you know, that is a nod to Aphex Twin and Warp Records. With Did You Miss Me, that's a nod to, I don't know, David Holmes and LCD. Panzer Attack is a definite nod to to Primal Scream. Murder Song is a definite nod to Constellation Records, Godspeed You Black Emperor, Silver Mount Zion, and that kind of thing. So, we wanted our tastes to be reflected in our output, and that's why the record is like it is.
Yeah, and I saw you said, I mean, skipping ahead a bit, but when it came to an end, you said you kind of paved the way for other bands in terms of the style. Is that right?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think what I meant by that was saying the record company learned a lot from us and then applied it all to Kasabian, which went mental. I think that I don't actually agree with that 100% anymore, although it certainly suited my thinking at the time. But yeah, that's what that was. I mean, you know, there were a lot of things like the Ting Tings and, yeah, Kasabian, and where there were eclectic influences or dance influences inflected in those records. But yeah, I mean, I'm not sure that was down to us. I mean, we were looking at other bands who were doing the same thing, as I just said. So it was kind of, nothing's original. It's all, you know, you take your cues from somewhere.
And yeah, just looking back at the early days, like, did you feel you were part of a scene, like a community of bands, or were you like busy doing your own thing?
Kind of busy doing our own thing. I mean, but we, looking back on it, we had more in common with, you know, Muse, really, than we had with the Strokes. And that, you know, that's not cool. I think at the time we would have liked it to be the other way around, but at the same time, we wanted to be more eclectic and diverse than the kind of what is basically the reductive sound of the Strokes. So, for instance, so yeah. Yeah, I mean, I remember going before kind of the Strokes came out and galvanized the whole thing. I do remember being at an NME awards show where it was, I think, Doves and Mercury Rev and Elbow, but also Annual Notice by the Trailer of the Dead were there, and all these different things. And there being cover mounts on the NME where you've got Alfie and Kings of Convenience, but you've also got David Holmes and LCD Sound System, and you've, and I don't know what else, Gang Gang Dance and Primal Scream. And I liked it better. It reflected my worldview better when there wasn't a scene, a galvanized scene, when it was splintered and varied and everything was different and there was that. I love a scene. I love kind of Britpop. I love the kind of what the kind of NME scene kind of became. I like it. And I like that you can pick them up almost as tangible objects and place them at one point or another in history. But I love the diversity of the era between Britpop and the Strokes. I thought that suits my tastes.
Yeah. Like, did you have like any real bond with like any of the bands? You know, obviously, like a bit later on, like you say, there was like a real community between bands. Was there anyone that you were like, weren't you pretty close with Biffy Clyro?
Yeah, we were. That was because we toured together. We were quite sort of grumpy and sullen, to be perfectly honest with you. And I think we were suspicious of other bands, and we were suspicious of making friends with other bands for the sake of it, which I now regret, because I think you can... I think it's absolutely fine to go, oh, I recognise you from the NME. Oh, I recognise you from the NME too. Let's have a chat.
Yeah,
we were really, like, we didn't like doing that. We kind of, I mean, I was probably the most friendly, but the others were just kind of, you know, quite suspicious and cagey, and, you know, didn't want to, there was a sort of thing about not selling out, but certainly sort of playing the game too much. So it was, we did do that. But in answer to your question, we were friends with Biffy because they supported us on tour, and we were friends with Medium 21 because they supported us on tour. We were friends. We weren't right. friends with Muse, but we knew Muse because we supported them on tour. So every band that we were friends with wasn't. It was because we'd met them, and then if you're at the NME Awards and you've hung out with, Nick from Kaiser Chiefs, it's not necessarily that the rest of the band will have done it. We didn't really do stuff like that where it was kind of like one homogenous unit making friends with another homogenous unit. It was kind of, So that's kind of the rambled, shitty answer.
And then, looking back at the albums, like I saw a note on Wikipedia that said thanks to Five and Westlife for their ongoing financial support. You're on the same label as them.
The same group of labels, I think. But that was a kind of, I mean, that ties into the fear of selling out and playing a game and keeping it real. So that was a kind of nod to that. I mean, I would have preferred to have been on a Rough Trade or a Wichita or whatever. But that said, the logic with those weren't offers that were on the table. The logic of going with RCA was that if you've got something to say, then, put yourself in a position to say it to the most amount of people possible. And that was the view. And that's a view that tallies with me far better now than it did at the time. I mean, when we first went into a recording session, I was suspicious about using Pro Tools. It's like, that's how ingrained the sense of sort of selling out was, that, you discount things, perfectly fine things. And I don't really know where that comes from, because I'm not really old enough to be, dyed in the wool 80s brown rice indie. But weird.
Is that something you lot felt, Tom? Like, obviously you got a major record deal. Was there any, did you have a plan of trying to get on something like Rough Trade, or were you never that bothered?
I think what happened with us was I think we only got offers from like major labels, really. I honestly think we just didn't have we didn't try and go anywhere else with it anyway. And that was like, it just, because we were so young as well, it was like, it just felt amazing. It was like, I'm going to be on like a big label kind of thing. I didn't think it through enough, I don't think. But, you never know which way it could have gone, I guess.
Like, how young were you?
Indie. I think I was 17, okay. Maybe going on 18. So, it's proper. You were quite young though as well.
Yeah, I was 18, I think. I can't remember that. But, and the rest of them were older. I mean, I think I sort of think that's too young for a rock band. I think sort of 25, the ideal age, because you've had a bit of, I'd deferred on art school to spend a year working in a shop and doing the band. And then by the time that year was up, it looked like we were about to get signed, and we did. And I didn't move out of my mum and dad's for quite a few years, because I was never there. There was no point. But even then you're on tour, there's like catering, or you get, you go down the road and get a sandwich, you're in the studio and you're catered to. I mean, there's no adult life experience there.
No, exactly. That's exactly it.
You don't get any until until the band breaks up.
Or until things go wrong, and then you're like, shit, all right, I should have done that differently. Yeah. Now I've learned, kind of thing.
For someone who's, life's ambition was to be on the cover of the NME and being on it by the time you're 20. Incredible. Going to Japan. What amazing. Going to America. Amazing. Like no one gets that shit. Consider myself and the rest of us so, lucky really to have been able, there was a point, and I don't think it's like this anymore. And this is, this is what I can't remember, Brett or Matt from Suede said it about a year ago. But there was, at that point, being in a band, being, it was like the, it was the peak of human existence. It was like the best thing. Why would you want to do anything else? I don't think it's like that anymore.
Yeah, I agree. It's completely changed everything on it. And it's not as easy to do it anymore either.
Oh, no, like, no. Absolutely.
Like, not that it was easy, but I mean, like, you know, the record deals like we used to get, they're just non-existent now anyway. So it's like the kids nowadays have to do it themselves, if you like. Uh-huh. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, you know, that, and that, and there's a lot to be said for that, and it's liberating, and to it's liberating to be DIY and to do stuff on your own terms. But you know, that financial kick and having the, and the opportunities that led to, it was absolutely incredible.
Yeah, you mentioned the NME, and I noticed you were got on the cool list in 2002. Was that a bit of a surreal feeling, or did you take much notice of it at the time?
I played it down, secretly loved it, still love it. Just to, yeah, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, I could sit there and go, oh, you know, I don't listen to that nonsense. What a load of rubbish. It's just about the music, isn't it? You know, and if, but bollocks, like fucking hell. Like the biggest music paper in UK when, you know, between London and New York, you were kind of the twin capitals of the music world at that point, puts you in a list of like ridiculous, like elitist, like nonsense thing. Like, of course, yeah. But, yeah.
What number were you again?
34.
I can't remember.
Whatever. You're thinking, get in there.
What were you told?
I might have been 17, yeah.
Don't mention it much, but
it really annoys me that Jamie Reynolds is on that.
Yeah, that was the other thing as well. Yeah. Every time you were in it or whatever, there was always someone in there where you're like, oh, maybe this actually doesn't mean a fucking thing.
It seems mental to me now that Pete and Carl were joint number one. Anyway, we've spent a bit too much time talking about the cool list.
The second album came out only a year after the first. Was that, were you trying to like capitalise on the early success, or how did that work?
I don't know, really. I can't remember. I think we were quite... It's all we wanted to do. When was that? Because let me...
What 2003?
It might have been like early 1 year that See This Through came out and then late the next year. So it might not actually be... That, I mean, that seems mental quick to me.
I think I read it's 18 months difference maybe, yeah.
That's mad. But I don't know. It was all we were doing. I mean, I don't think it was a great master plan or, you know, a specific motivation. It's just that's what we wanted to do. So we, you know, we made the first record. And in fact, we've been making the first record for quite a long time before it came out, doing EPs and recording a little bit and then going away and recording a little bit and going away, you know, touring the record. And then, it's how we lived our lives, I suppose. And also we were, you know, particularly Tom and Fisher were so creative and so, you know, we just had more material immediately. I mean, we've been writing B-sides that, you know, we thought were really good, but we very much took that approach that, you know, okay, this song's great. Maybe it's too good to be a B-side. Do you know what? We'll write more songs, just put it out as the B-side. We'd like being the band with the B-sides. Amazing. So, yeah, but we built our own studio for the second record. We took that industrial unit and put in a load of recording equipment and some separating walls and a window into the live room, like a real studio. And, and we made the record in there. We made it with Dan Austin, who who engineered the first record, because we felt that we, having made the first, arrogantly, but rightly, we felt that we would like more of a hands-on approach to the production from us. And we felt that if we did it with Dan, who was our age and, you know, who we got on with really well and still do, that, you know, we could get what we wanted without having a producer. And the label backed us amazingly, and it came off. That record still sounds fucking brilliant.
We asked bands if, like, the pressure changed, like, when they go into the second album in terms of the label wanting maybe more commercial success. Is that something you guys felt, or not really?
Not really. Well, a little bit, but we felt that it was... I suppose we felt it was achievable, and, you know, we had on that second record, we had Promises, and which I think was our biggest single. And then, but we also had Blind Pilots, which we felt would be the even bigger still, and wasn't, unfortunately, for one reason or another. I mean, we were quite well protected by our A&R man, actually. And we didn't feel a lot of the pressure. And also we were the kind of band who would, like, rather than, and this happened time and time again, rather than, like, take a tour profit and just give ourselves some money, we'd throw it into the next tour. We'd have a bigger lighting rig, a bigger PA rig, and you know, that's the reason I say that, is to illustrate our sense of priorities at that time. It was kind of very much back, like, everything should go back into the band. The band is everything.
Am I right in thinking that got to number 5 in the album charts as well?
I thought it was 4, but whatever. yeah, I mean, it did all right. It did pretty well.
Is that a good feeling, obviously, when that happens, though?
Yeah, of course. I mean, when I think it must have been Let's Kill Music, when we put that out in, you know, that was our first proper single, our first proper chart-eligible single. We'd had a couple of EPs before that. But when we put that out, I remember being on tour, and I think we were in... I don't know. It was up north or in Scotland. Not to sound too southern about it, but we were listening to the chart countdown, and it got higher and higher on the chart, and it hadn't come up. And Ben, bless him, stayed in the van listening to the radio all the way to the end, and we found out later that evening they'd gone in at 41. I mean, you know, it was. I mean, you start off and it's kind of important, and then you kind of. I don't know. By the time we got there, I suppose we were pleased, but I don't remember it being, you know, we didn't have a party or anything.
Yeah, obviously you get to the point, 2005, where you leave for 30 Pretty Things. Can you just tell us a bit about that time and how you came to that decision?
I mean, by that time, I moved up to London had met my girlfriend at the time, and we had a baby. And... The band was still based in Reading, which is fine, and we were making starting to write and record stuff for the third record, which for some reason, and I think it was something to do with the record label. I think the A&R guy had been elbowed out, and we were kind of given a new A&R guy who wanted to take a slightly new approach, which we were open to, but it meant that it was really slow going. So I was driving from London to Reading every day. Anna was working every day, so I would either drop Nico, my daughter, who's now spectacularly in sick form, driving across to Reading every day with her, dumping her at my mum's a couple of days, taking her into the studio maybe, and it was just... It took its toll, and the recording process wasn't really going very well. Everything was, it was really hard going, and the album that came out at the end was pretty good, but it was, you know, that it was, so we labored so hard over those songs, and it was a really difficult time. Not a difficult time. It wasn't like we had cholera or anything, but it was very, it was hard work. And then in the meantime, I'd been Carl was living about literally 5 doors down from me in the video for Wandering, where him and I can't remember which way around. I think he comes and gives me a knock, but we literally were like 5 doors down from each other. That video is accurate. We've been hanging out. The Libertines was coming to an end. I hopped on stage with them Rockhamring or Rocking Park, I think, a year before, and we were mates. And the Libertines were breaking up, and he had this thing that he was putting together with Gary and Anthony, and they needed a bass player. And I wasn't having much fun with the Coopers, and I jumped ship.
How did that go down with your old bandmates then?
Well, I remember calling a meeting. Yeah, I think I drove down to Bath. Yeah, we were recording in Bath actually by the end of that process as well, so it was even harder going. But I remember having a meeting and sort of and telling them, and their response was, "What can we do?" And I said, "Look, I haven't taken this decision lightly. It's what I've done." And then, you know, they were upset, and but they, you know, cracked on and I got on with it.
Yeah, I read a quote that said, you wouldn't have left if you thought they wouldn't have been able to carry on. Is that right?
Yeah, I guess so. I'd forgotten about it that I'd said that. But that seems good enough.
And am I right in thinking there's a bit of a battle over the name Dirty Pretty Things?
In what sense?
In like the sense that a couple of other bands already had it or something.
Yeah, that was what, I mean, it's not the most original name in the world, is it? But the, and obviously, you know, the fact that other bands were called that reflects that. That was a band in Australia that I think we had to bung some money to so that they, you know, they had the same name. Obviously the film had the same name. The other name, the original name for the band, we never quite settled on it. Carl wanted to be called, the Romans initially, which I really liked. And then he wanted it to be called the Princelings, which I didn't like. And I can't remember. And then I think Wolfpack or something was in the mix there. I think Gary suggested that. And then we settled on Dirty Pretty Things. And that was the name. That was the name of Carl's girlfriend at the time's club night that he ran.
Oh, yeah. I remember
that. We pinched the name and then they changed their name to Bright Young Things or something, you know.
Was Anthony already in the band then?
Kind of. I mean, you know, it's not as linear as that. It was, obviously they'd been on the road, the three of them, with John.
Yeah, because he played for Libertines for a bit, didn't he?
Exactly, yeah. So when Pete became unreliable and it became clear that they needed someone to be on stage playing his parts, that's when, I think there was a trip to the States for an American tour and Pete couldn't go for whatever reason and they got Rough Trade to ask their New York hipster mates who was the hot gunslinger from the Bowery, and it was Anthony, the Oscar-winning composer.
Yeah, he is now, isn't he?
Yeah. So him and Carl and Gary had been on the road, and obviously, you know, it was obvious that the Libertines didn't have much gas left in the tank at that point. And, you know, it's quite natural to be planning your next steps. And if you're in a tin can on wheels for hugely extended periods with the same group of people, then you're going to be discussing it with them. And, you know, the chemistry between Anthony and Carl, even now, is, you know, is profound. And they're great mates, and it's very natural between the two of them to do stuff together. So, yeah, I think it was quite natural the way it came together. And then obviously I wasn't there, so you know, I came later, but that's fine too.
What was the writing process like in Dirty Pretty Things?
It varied a bit. It was, Carl already had Bang Bang and Deadwood.
Because it was, yeah,
he already had those two, so he was, and I remember being at Best of All, actually. I think we were both DJing at Best of All, and we camped together, so that's it, you know. And he had Deadwood and Bang Bang. I remember him playing them to me and thinking they were decent. And then for, he had the riff to Gin and Milk, and then we really put that together as a band. I mean, we had a little studio rehearsal room in Waterloo. That's what the album's called, Waterloo to Anywhere. And we went there every day and we played for 6 hours bashing these songs away. And yeah, I mean, that's, I think that first album, that, you know, we sound sort of robust and muscular. I always thought we kind of had that on, you know, it was like a more muscular version of the Libertines. But obviously with that, you take away the impending sense of chaos that was so exciting about that band. So, you know, swings and roundabouts. But yeah, so it varied. For the second record, it was different. I mean, Carl didn't do as much, although he did. He in the end, he contributed a lot. But that was, you know, me and Anthony going around to Anthony's and writing songs every day for 18 months. And Carl would pop in occasionally and like throw in an idea. And then, yeah. So, it was different. And then, you know, with, I don't know, The Enemy, it was something that I started and then that we built out with, with Chinese Dogs. It was an Anthony thing. I think Gin and Milk maybe been an Anthony thing. But, yeah, the first album was very much the four of us together. It was like someone would have an idea and we'd build it out.
Is this a point you two met each other then, Tom, or you didn't meet each other before?
Yeah, I think it was, wasn't it?
I'd been to see you guys. I thought it was definitely when I was in the Coopers. In fact, it was definitely before Nico was born. Maybe I was pregnant with Nico. But the we were talking about it the other day, weren't we, Tom? I came to you at like a basement club in like Mayfair or Knightsbridge or somewhere posh. It felt a bit odd. Right. But it was great, and you were, you know, remember you especially being really magnetic, and I remember thinking you were a bit like Damon Albarn, which you're not.
Really?
But that's what I remember thinking.
The first. I'll take it, though.
Yeah, so I think...
Was it a troubadour or something like that?
Maybe.
Oh, I don't know. Like we always say, like, I fucking can't remember a lot. I remember the first time I saw you though, Did was I didn't meet you, but I saw you at Glastonbury. You were playing with the Coopers, and someone threw a shoe at your head. Can you remember that?
Really vaguely, yeah.
You remember being hit by a shoe at Glastonbury on stage?
Yeah.
It might have been Grant actually. He was with me.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
I sort of vaguely remember that. I'd forgotten all about it until you said.
Yeah, it happened. But I'm not sure when we actually first met. It's got to be when you started playing with Dirty Pretty Things.
I would have thought so. Although, you know, there was, I don't know, but there was probably a Lisa Moorish connection there as well somewhere, because you guys were mates. Yeah. I was mates with her a bit, and I can't remember.
And did you feel like you say, you didn't really feel part of a community back with Cooper Temple Closeted, but at that point, did you feel more connected to other bands?
Kind of. I guess we knew more bands. I mean, it was, you know, but we were away a lot. I have this conversation all the time, like that, you know, that back in London, people were going to Frog and whatever else. And, you know, there was a real sort of bustling scene. But we weren't really here. You know, we recorded the first album quite sensibly, taking us out of London, because the behaviour would have been dreadful and unproductive had we stayed in London to record. But we did, the first album was recorded in Glasgow and LA. The second album was recorded in LA. The rest of the time we're on tour, pretty much. It felt like we were more similar in sound to a lot of bands, and a lot of bands were more similar in sound and kind of seemingly cut from the same cloth. But, you know, we weren't hanging out with the Unstrung or anything. It was kind of, it moved a bit beyond that while we'd been away, to be honest.
And then obviously you've got Alan McGee in common as well.
Yeah, of course.
So what was it like working with him?
Well, Alan's brilliant. He's so sort of, he's got such a sense of what works and what doesn't. And actually, you know, he said many brilliant things and got very excited about a lot of stuff in our time together. But the best thing he did, and this is a little bit fast forward to the end, was that when we released the second record, and we took ages to make the second record so that it didn't, you know, it was sort of doomed before we started. And then we did a tour of the UK, which wasn't as big as the tour of the UK we'd done before. And, you know, it all felt like it was winding down. And he had the good sense to go, yeah, I think you should split up. This isn't sexy anymore. Well, I should have done the voice. So that was kind of one of the best things he did. And, someone of that experience who can be that objective about something that could be potentially quite emotional. And also, you know, he doesn't need the money, but that's an income stream for him as well. If he's putting the lid on a band, then, you know, that's quite a big thing and quite a smart thing. So, he was great. And obviously the stories and the legacy is amazing. So, you know, good. And I bump into him from time to time and message him and stuff. And he's sort of, he's sort of more mental now than he was back then.
But like, I just love meeting up with him every now and again and just having a chat, and he just goes off on one of his tangents of telling you amazing stories about whatever.
His Instagram's kind of mental, because he had what was it? He had that like apple vinegar thing for his belly that he was banging on about for ages, and this was a few years ago. And now he's kind of like banging. One of his posts of like him in trainers, like outside some closed shop, with his AirPods in, like going, and the caption's like, I walk 10 miles a day now. I do all my meetings while I'm walking. It's brilliant. Like, what? Okay. Yeah. Fucking McGee.
And he said when we had him on, he said he had quite a good relationship with Carl. Like, he said sometime about saving his eye or something, but were those two quite close?
Yeah, I mean, but the Libertines were managed by kind of a friend of Gary's who was a lawyer, Banny. And then when they became kind of fractious, I can't remember the exact timing of it, but when it became hard, they became harder to manage. And make no mistake, Pete Ducky is, you know, a hard guy to manage. I think Alan stepped in, and they felt that they needed a more experienced, stronger hand to kind of hold the reins, literally in some cases. So Alan had stepped in then, and I guess him and Carl were, you know, it would have been very much Carl's decisions. And Alan's decisions and acting as one mind, in terms of running the band. So yeah, they would have been close from that. I mean, yeah, kind of, I mean, Alan was on board before I was on board. It was all set up by the time I got there. But yeah, they were close. And the story about the eye, I can't remember how it happened, but Carl and Pete had been up to Alan's in Wales, Alan's country manor, literally, and they were writing songs, and I think they probably had quite a lot to drink and maybe some other stuff, I don't know, and they had a big fight, and then Carl went away, and I don't know if he slipped or he did it on purpose, but he smashed his head up on a sink, and they ran the story of it in the NME, and I think, I don't know whether Alan was there or not, but yeah, but you know, they Carl had a tough time at the back end of the Libertines' first incarnation, and Alan, you know, was instrumental in helping him and seeing him through that time. So, yeah,
yeah. What was Carl like at that point? Like, when you start in the band, is he a bit jaded from that time in the Libertines, or is he like raring to go with a new project?
He was raring to go. He was ambitious about it in a way that I wasn't. At the time, I remember him saying that he wanted to be the biggest band in Britain. He wanted to be, you know, I think at the time, I mean, things like Coldplay aside, I think, you know, he won the Kaiser Chiefs were I don't know, the Kaiser Chiefs were enormous, Razor Light were enormous, Kasabian and enormous. He wanted to be as big as them, and that was his ambition. It was about, you know, being the biggest, and I didn't really have that, but he did. So yeah, he was raring to go, and I think he wanted. I think there was a thing with the Libertines, and that at the time, and I don't think it's as true now, that there was a kind of idea that it was Pete. You know, he was really the driving. He was the creative force, and that Carl was kind of just someone to sort of steer him in the right direction and give him the tools to give him the kind of the vessel for his creativity. And I think Carl, there was quite a strong sense that he wanted to disprove that he could, you know, he could do it without Pete. And he did, you know.
Yeah, I mean, that first single went in at number 5, Bang Bang, You're Dead.
At 4.
Is it four again?
I don't know.
Obviously, like you mentioned, Libertines, and obviously like overt references to Pete in that song and stuff. How did you find it? Like,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I can leave no comment on that if you want. But yeah, in terms of the Libertines and that kind of I don't know, almost hanging over you, like, but you played Libertine songs live. Is that something you just embraced, or you kind of knew that was going to be part of the course?
Yeah, I mean, I think we had to do it. There was a sense that, you know, it was the same. It was the same fans, and we. I think we only played sort of Carl songs. You know, we played. They were. I don't know. Yeah, we played Carl songs because Carl was in our band, and there was, you know, there was a sense that the gigs would be better for the crowd if they heard songs that they knew and recognised, and we hadn't put any out. So yeah, we definitely started with, you know, Boys in the Band, So I Get Along, Death on the Stairs, Plan A we did quite a lot, France we did quite a lot, I don't remember, but too many others. But yeah, I mean, I also can't remember if we kind of, as we sort of wrote more material, whether we started to ditch them. I sort of suspect not, but I don't know.
Yeah, I read an article where I think you played one gig where you didn't play any Libertine songs, but you did a Nirvana cover instead.
Now, the Nirvana cover was sort of a bit ill-advised, I think, but it seemed like a good idea at the time. But then
which one was it?
I can't even remember what the song was called. Is it
In Bloom, I think.
I think, yeah, In Bloom. But we did it because we were playing the main stage at Reading. And, you know, this shows how messed up we were at the time and overindulging. But we we decided to do a Nirvana cover because it was Reading, and Reading and Nirvana was so much to do with, you know, the Reading Festival main stage. So we did it. But in hindsight, it looks ridiculous.
I wonder if there's like a video of it or anything.
I'd love to see that.
Thanks for listening to this episode of 22 Grand Pod. If Naughty's guitar music is your thing, then you might enjoy our Patreon page, where for £3 a month you will get access to the following series. The Naughty's Deep Dive, where we go through the likes of the Stalking Pete Doherty documentary in painful detail. My favourite 2000s album, where patrons and other guests come on to talk about their favourite album of the era. Legend or Landfill, in which we go through Enemy's top 10 albums of each year from 2001 and see if we think they are indeed legendary or for the landfill. Unsigned Stories, where we chat to bands that didn't quite make it in terms of signing that elusive record deal. We also have Fan Stories, where I talk to people about their memories and opinions on all things Naughty's Indie. You also get early access to any main podcast episodes, and it's also worth checking out the YouTube page, where you can see extended video versions of the interviews, as well as plenty of other bits of commentary and opinion. All links are in the description. Now back to the pod. We try and get people to tell the Liam Gallagher story, but I was reading something on NME where you guys are playing a gig at London's Proud Gallery and he nearly joined you on stage or something.
Yeah, I don't remember. I mean, my memory is pretty excellent up until 2005 and then it absolutely falls off a cliff. So yeah, don't know about that.
Fair enough. It says something about him like getting to the front and banging a drumstick around or something. I don't know.
Maybe that happened. I don't know. It sounds feasible. Sure. I actually saw Liam sort of semi-recently. I was out running and him and Debbie live not too far away from me. And it was just at the start of the first lockdown. So not too recently, but recently enough. And I didn't recognise him, and he didn't see me because I don't look like me when I'm running because I'm in running gear. But I recognised Paul. He was with Paul, his brother. And then I looked at who Paul was walking with, and it was this kind of, you know, mad, like, Britpop wizard, and he had like his hood up and a massive beard and really long hair. So that's not a very good story, now that I've said it out loud, but that's what happened.
Britpop wizard is good there. I'm enjoying that.
Like some Old Testament prophet. But he, Liam and Noel have always been super lovely to me. I don't know them very well at all. I mean, obviously, there's the Soccer AM thing with Noel with the milk spitting.
I was going to ask you about that. You spat at Tim Lovejoy, didn't you?
Yeah. I have a period of it, actually. I remember being at a festival as well and jumping on set and hijacking Tom Kasabian's interview with someone and like jetting. I don't call it spitting. I call it jetting. It's different. And jetting water at the presenter there, and that I think that's on TV's, you know, TV's biggest idiots moments or something. I remember seeing it again on some kind of list. But yeah, I mean, Noel and Sarah have always been super lovely to me. Liam's always been great. I did once have an incident with Gem where I'd been at, I don't know why, but I'd been to see Bonehead's new band at Notting Hill Arts Club.
Right.
And then a few nights later, I was at, what's that pub in Camden, the Amy Winehouse pub?
Holy Arts.
Yeah. And then I was at the Hawley a few nights later, and I guess they were BDI by that point. BDI were there, maybe. I don't know. It was definitely Andy and Gem and Liam. And the bass player in Bonehead's new band that I'd seen a few nights before looked like Gem, like, but with a Beatles kind of tash, the sort of, he looked like a cross between Gem and McCartney, so much so that I thought it was Gem with a tash playing in Bonehead's band. So the few nights later when I'd see Gem, who I don't really know, but we got chatting, I said, I thought, I like the fact that you were playing in Bonehead's band the other night, which he took completely the wrong way. And there was a kind of fracas that ended up with Liam and Carl taking Gem off to the toilets and me making a hasty exit and Andy Bell telling me just not to talk to Gem anymore. But that was, that's another related story. Probably as entertaining as it was in my head.
Did he come round with it or what?
I can't remember. I think it fizzled out. But I'd meant it really nicely, and he took it like I was. He took it to mean that he shouldn't be in the band that he's in, which you were at. No, not what I meant.
Right, it'd be quite a funny rag actually. But
I'll tell it better next time.
And then yeah, I suppose it's a bit of an NME question, Dids. But you talked about Pete and him being a bit hard to handle. Like, what was your experience of Pete Docky? Was there any time where he kind of made life difficult for Carl during the day, Pretty Things here or anything?
I don't think so. Not in actuality. I thought when we kicked off, when we started the band or early in discussing it, there was the specter of Pete kind of loomed quite large. It wasn't a good relationship, and I was quite conscious of being told that I was, you know, a Pete wannabe and, you know, stepping into shoes that were too big for me, which that kind of never came up. The only time it ever came up was on our first ever little tour, which we did in Italy because we wanted to kind of do some gigs without out of the spotlight. And I think for a couple of the gigs we were supported by the others, and Dom, who, you know, it was good mates with Pete, was the only person ever to say to our faces something along the lines of, "You guys will never be Pete Doherty." But other than that, it was, you know, we sometimes got Pete was crackers at the time and hanging out with, like, crackers is probably the wrong choice of word, but and quite dark in a kind of, it's true to say, and this isn't my personal experience, but the experience of people that I know and know well, that when you start getting into darker drugs, it brings with it a kind of dirtier, gangstery kind of element with it quite readily. And I think Pete was in that world back then. Mm. As a knock-on effect of that, there was kind of a sense that maybe if he turned up, then it would be heavy, but it never actually happened, you know.
But I completely get where you're coming from, where you would see these certain people hanging around more and more, like the darker it got, definitely, you know. And it was just, yeah, there were some dodgy people that he was talking about with Pete, weren't they?
I mean, I think there's an element of it being, you know, you see it a little bit with Amy as well, where you've got, you know, people see people who are, you know, who have a weakness, let's call it a weakness for want of a better word, and they want to capitalize on it. They want to prey upon, you know, people who who are desperate and be their mate, particularly when they're, you know, on the coolest and, you know, top of the pops and everything. So, you know, that's just what happens, isn't it? To be clear, I mean, I knew Pete a little bit when, in the early days of the Libs, I kind of, you know, I went to see them in Southampton and we hung out and I kind of, there was, and at Enemy Awards and whatever else, you know, I didn't have his number or anything, but we always had a good chat. But you know, I don't know Pete really. And we haven't hung out a lot. So at all, certainly not over the past few years. In fact, the last time I spoke to Pete was when they were in Thailand making that record. What was it? Songs for a Doomed Youth or something. The comeback record. And Roger Sargent was with them. And it was at a time when Roger and I were working on Suede's Night Thoughts movie. And so we had this kind of Skype conversation and Pete popped up in the background and went, "Oi, Dids, get your hair cut," and then ran off again. And then that was the last I saw of him.
So yeah, then moving back to the relationship between like Dirty Pretty Things and the Paddingtons, like obviously there was a point where Josh joined for a bit. So obviously at that point, you must have been quite close in terms of the two bands.
There was a night in, I think we were in Taiwan. What a ludicrous way to start a sentence. And Carl stayed up too late. And he was at some bar, because it's Taiwan and it's hot. It was an outdoor bar. And he got on the back of some dude's motorbike and he came off the back immediately and he broke his collarbone. which is, as far as rock and roll injuries go, that's a pretty good one. But the upshot was that we had a load of gigs that he couldn't play the guitar for. So we knew the Paddingtons pretty well by this point, Josh particularly, and Josh came on tour with us. And you know, I think it was a full tour of the States, which was amazing, really, that the Paddingtons were so gracious as to sort of loan us their guitarist for a little while. But yeah. And me and Josh had some quite funny incidents, like not going to Courtney Love's house. And what else? Oh, yeah, there was the night when he got in a fight and stole a bouncer's phone in Cambridge. And the bouncer came back to our tour bus and with a mate and a golf club. And Josh had thrown the guy's phone out of the cab, and the bouncer forcibly took him back there to find it, and they found it. And then I think he made our tour manager give him like a few thousand pounds as well. So, you know.
Yeah, I remember Josh ringing me about that. He's absolutely shitted himself.
That was nuts. But it did result in one of the best quotes I've ever heard, which was the bouncer whacking his golf club on the floor and shouting at Josh to come out and saying, "I ain't messing around. This is Cambridge, bitch." What do you mean? That's how intimidating, the seat of learning. God, yeah, this is Cambridge, bitch.
What was the Courtney Love story?
Nothing. It was just, I think we were on tour. Carl and Anthony went. Courtney Love had she sort of followed us around a little bit, and I think she must have been at the show. And then Carl and Anthony went back to hers, not in a sex way, don't think. I said to Josh, "You don't want to go there. Those people are fucking vampires. let's go and get a drink." And that's what we did.
Fair play.
you'll know now why I didn't just tell that story, because it's not that good.
It's all interesting stuff. Didn't you match her on a dating website, Tom, once or something?
Amazing. Might have done, yeah. I think I was just curious. Very, very curious. See if she fancied me or not. I mean,
what was the verdict?
I think a couple of things were said, and then I mentioned that I knew a guitarist, and that was it. Yeah, because I was hanging out with Mikko a bit at the time, actually, and then I was like, "Oh yeah, I know you're a guitarist, Mikko." And then I don't think she replied after that. She must have. Who knows? That could have been very funny, though. How old is she? She probably could be my mum.
Yeah, I think so.
Like going through all the NME stuff and picking up a few stories, and there's just a random one about you're playing a gig in a seal enclosure in a zoo in Ibiza.
Oh shit! Yeah, we did do that.
The seals there, or
no, they weren't. I think that was the night when we were supported by the NME. And we went back to our, because back then you did Ibiza Rocks, and they gave you like an incredible villa with a pool and stuff, and a driver and access to stuff. And they and we went back to our villa with the NME, and we were kind of, me and Carl were throwing people in the pool, and the bass player, I can't remember what his name is, but he didn't, and quite reasonably, he didn't want to be thrown in the pool. So we kind of like, we were backing him up, and it was all, you know, meant in fun. And we backed him up to, you know, the barbecue area. The barbecue wasn't on, but he kind of like reached behind him to sort of feel where the barbecue was. And he came away with a huge fucking knife in his hand and started waving it around at us. And we were like, whoa. And then the enemy had to come and calm him down. But it was, that was like we...
the bass player of the enemy. He was like, they were proper young kids as well, weren't they?
I don't remember us being young kids. Oh, not the enemy. Sorry, the twang.
Oh, the twang, right?
The bass player from the enemy.
He was about 12. Doesn't sound like the enemy at all.
No, it was a twang. but that was a show in a seal enclosure, which was pretty mental. There weren't any seals there. I don't remember whether there were any people there, to be honest. But yeah, I remember turning up for sound check and it being a bit of a, you know, mad old thing.
Did you play that, Tom? Like, I know you had a story about being with The View there or something.
No, we actually never did Ibiza Rock, but I like Didge was just saying, I'd gone with The View or something, and we stayed in some posh villa and was jumping off the roof and all that shit. It was probably the same villa anyway.
Yeah.
It was just a party. I wasn't actually playing there.
Did you play any gigs together, you two?
Yeah, we did quite a few, didn't we?
Did we?
It was Dirty Pretty Things, yeah. We did a few. We definitely did one at the Astoria.
Okay, I just remembered one. Didn't we do one together on New Year's Eve at the Ironworks?
Yes.
In Scotland.
Scotland.
But it was Chris McCormack's night.
Yeah, I remember that. New Year's party, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, God.
That was
it. What was the Astoria thing? Was that just a gig?
Wasn't it like the last gig to be played at like Mean Fiddler or something like that? I can't remember if we played Astoria or it was Mean Fiddler, but I remember someone was like, oh yeah, this is going to be the last gig before it shuts down.
Oh, I vaguely remember that. That makes sense.
We supported you and then... We shut it down, yeah.
And then, we would have done festivals and stuff on the same bill and into each other all over.
We played the Isle of Skye. Did you play that? We don't even remember, do we?
I don't remember that. I remember doing Rockness. I think it was the first ever Rockness.
Me
and Carl had stayed up too late again, and we ended up getting about 2 hours sleep and then having to do the show. In fact, we did. It was terrible, really. There was a couple of shows, and I really, really regret this, but I'll say it almost by way of an apology. There was a couple of shows. One was in Belgium or Brussels, and we did. It was a festival, and we turned up, and our tour manager said, "Look, I think we should pull the show because you're too wasted." And we insisted on going on, and the crew didn't even know what. You know, they didn't think we were all playing the same song. And there was another, and we should have pulled the show. It was awful and an awful way to treat members of the public who have parted with their own money to see you play. And there was another time, where it was just me, but I sort of stayed up too late on my own and just kept going. And, you know, I could barely play. This was in Oxford. It was on. It was as the band was really winding down anyway. But again, you know, terrible behaviour. And, you know, sorry to anyone that wasted their money on coming to see, you know, an idiot or four. It was never Gary. failed to play an instrument.
Is that what happened on Soccer AMD? Kind of just like not go to bed?
Yeah, absolutely. That's 100% what happened. We'd had a gig in Wolverhampton the night before. We had a gig the next night in Wolverhampton, but we'd had a gig the night before and we'd come down and we'd stayed up. I think that was the same. This is so fucking stupid. Yeah, that was the time when Carl, we got fined by Addison Leave, when Carl sort of drawing something with a Sharpie on the back of the seat of the Addy Lee. But I think that was after Soccer AM. I think that was the cab from Soccer AM up to Wolverhampton. I don't know how we managed to do the Wolverhampton show. Maybe it was the other way around. But yeah, we definitely got fined by Addison Lee. And I think that was the same night. I think that show was to do something to do with MTV. And Zane was there. Pete Gunn, our tour manager, that a mic went missing. A microphone and our tour manager accused Zane Lowe of stealing the microphone, which is ridiculous because he's A, he's not that guy, and B, he's got, you know, more money than God. So yeah. Wild times.
Did anything happen with Noel Gallagher on that Soccer AM thing?
It was Noel's response was incredible, because you've got like football people, you've got Paul Robinson, I think someone else, and TV people, and they're really, really not used to that level of bad behavior and people being in that condition. And obviously, Noel Gallagher was in Oasis and has exactly, and is going to have more experience of that kind of situation than you do yourself. So, he was kind of, he was sat there at the end of the sofa, kind of like nodding and smiling and really not being amazed by what was happening in front of him at all.
Yeah, I remember a bit about when Carl was trying to talk about Live Forever, but he couldn't remember the title or something. And he was like, oh, what's that one again? The Garden Grows or something. No, it's like, I Live Forever. He's like, yeah, I like that one, mate. Yeah.
I do remember that when he said it, yeah. That's really funny. And it's also funny enough for it not to be really disrespectful.
I seem to remember Carl and Pete doing a similar thing a few years later. I think they turned up a bit worse for wear as well. But
yeah, I mean, we've all done it.
Yeah, I guess it's not great timing for a band, is it? 8 o'clock on a Saturday.
No, absolutely. And also, you know, we very much with Dirty Pretty Things, it was a, you know, we've kind of felt that if, as long as we had our, you know, leather jackets on, we could behave as badly as we wanted. There was an unspoken thing that, you know, we had an opportunity to like stay up really late every single night and act like Aerosmith in the 70s. And that's what we did. And because, you know, I mean, it's a less wise thing than what I was saying earlier about being the ambition to be on the cover of the NME and the opportunity that you get at that point for being in a band and it being the pinnacle of human existence. But, you know, if you've got the second band, it was kind of, okay, well, yeah, we're going to stay up really, really late every single night. And that, and that's what we did, which is, you know, nuts. But yeah, you kind of, you've got to sort of take that, well, you haven't got to, but we felt we had to take that opportunity. And so we did. But what happens after that is that when the band splits up and you don't have that privilege anymore, it's hard because you have those behavioral patterns, that are hard to stop, and you're left without something that has been the focus of your life for, you know, for me 10 years, and you're left with quite a thirst on, that was the hardest thing to outgrow it, to live past it. And you have about, I don't know, a year where you're still acting like you're in a band despite the fact that you're not. And yeah, that's tough.
I think I'm still in that phase now.
Yeah, but you had 2 years off, didn't you? After the past, you had 2 years of not drinking or smoking.
Yeah, to be honest, yeah, I haven't actually just been completely wasted since then. But yeah, like I was good for a while, and then obviously I had a kid as well. So that, you know, like as you know, I did. So how many kids have you got?
Four.
Yeah, like obviously that changes things a bit. Yeah, it is difficult to like come down from it a little bit, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I found it really hard.
Yeah, because it's obviously a lot of fun, and then you're like, shit, am I really boring now or what? And it's obviously still nice to just go and get hammered with your mates.
Yeah, on occasion, just not every night.
Yeah, just not every night anymore.
And then looking at that second album, Dids, I read that the recording of the album, well, this is words from Enemy, I think, but recording of the album was apparently fraught with the band relocating to Santa Monica to work with producer Nick Lehman. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, that was the... I mean, Anthony and I and Carl as well have been sort of bashing songs about for about a year. And McGee had the idea that, you know, we'd go off to LA with this guy Nick and he'd help us, you know, bash the songs into shape. So Nick's history was that he'd been, I think, a tour DJ for the Prodigy and then had gone into music production, but he was writing music for adverts and stuff, like soundtrack stuff. So and also it wasn't until McGee got on the plane over and listened to the latest demos that he realized that actually the songs were pretty much finished and we didn't need like help kicking the songs into shape. So we go over to make this record with a guy who isn't really a producer. And we're thousands and thousands of miles from home for 3 fucking months. And it was fraught, and you know, the bad behavior doesn't help with that kind of thing. I'd had to kind of uproot my family and transplant them to Santa Monica because we were away for so long, which is something that I didn't realize would be costing me money at that point, but it did. And then we came out with an album that works. We had to re-record and kind of, it wasn't recorded properly. Tech problem with it where it wasn't right for CD. We had to have bits of it re-recorded in London. We had a guy kind of do a lot of engineering work in making the files usable. It was a mess. And then by the time we got it into manageable, releasable kind of form, I'd kind of, you know, we, first of all, the music industry had moved on, because it does when you spend ages making a record, and no one fucking bought it. And and fair enough. But what I'd kind of, it's interesting because looking back at the Cooper stuff, I'd always been kind of the main person involved with the artwork and the look of things, certainly for those first two records. And by the time you get to Waterloo to Anywhere, which you get to Romance at Short Notice, it's a horrible cover. What a shitty cover. And I had nothing to do with it. I completely lost interest in that side of things. And lost interest in a lot of things, really. There was a sort of narrative from Mercury Records that we had to, you know, it made marketing sense statistically to have the band on the cover. You know, there is, you know, it makes... you know, they sell better generally. That was the marketing logic at the time, which is nonsense. You know, that's an insanely bad cover for a very difficult album. And again, that's kind of a patchy album. Yeah. I mean, yeah, that record isn't a very good memory for any of us, I don't think.
Going to artwork, the Cooper's first album, I actually really like the artwork from that debut. Is that like your house or something?
That was Tom's house, actually. Tom's house, yeah. Because I'm the most middle class. My upbringing was the most middle class upbringing you could possibly imagine, and the rest of the band are fairly similar. So we had, what happened with the artwork was that
You had two versions of it as well, didn't you?
It was a painted version, which I did that, I think.
Right, the
original version. But the I used to read a magazine, remember them, called Sleaze Nation, which was kind of a bit, you know, arts and culture, but and music and fashion and, you know, a bit like ID, but kind of an edgier version of ID or Dazed. And it had a guy in it who had a column called Jacques Peretti, and it was like a satirical sort of scathing view of everyday life or something, I don't know. He'd pick something and basically rip it apart, and it would be really sarcastic and funny. When we came to look at artwork ideas, me and the marketing guy at the label sort of both hit on the idea of this guy, Jacques Peretti, doing these satirical bits across all of our artwork. And, you know, the idea was that was basically developed to have this fictional Middle England family who were in the Let's Go music video as well, and then have Jacques Peretti write these kind of little scenarios against these very, very kind of clean photographs. So you've got this kind of vision of Middle England life, and then this little paragraph of text which rips it apart. And that was kind of the idea, really. Fun. You know, we did a lot of work on that, and I was pleased to work with someone. I was pleased to be able to work with someone whose work I liked already, you know, because quite often in the music industry, you think, you know, the Libertines working with Mick Jones is a good example where you work with your heroes and it really works. But, you know, it doesn't always happen like that. In fact, most of the time it really doesn't. And, you know, so that was quite good. I wouldn't go so far as to say Jacques Peretti was my hero, but I would say that it was nice to be able to work with someone that whose work you admired already. Not that I ever met him.
Looking back at the production on Waterloo to Anyway, you worked with Dave Sardy, who produced Oasis, and also Tony Dugan, who, Tom, you worked with as well.
I think everyone worked with Dugan. That was the Mogwai connection, wasn't it? Dugan was like the house engineer at Sava Studios in Glasgow, which were the places where Arab Strap and Delgados and Mogwai and all those Chemical Underground bands. So Dugan engineered all the albums by Delgados and Arab Strap and Mogwai, which are records that I absolutely love. You know, the second couple of Delgados records, and certainly the first two Mogwai records, and the first two Arab Strap albums as well. Anyway, Stephen King managed Mogwai as well as... Did they manage you, Tom?
Yeah, they started managing us for a bit, and they managed you at the same time, right?
Yeah, okay. So it was kind of a bit of a family thing, and there was the Charlatans, there was Steve Mason, before that, the Beta Band, and a few others. Alan also had the Pop Tones label, obviously. But Alan actively DJed. He had that club night with Danny Watson, didn't he, called Death Disco, Death Dingo, as Gary insists on calling it. And he had a huge crush on the song Are You Gonna Be My Girl by Jet. Because every time he put it on, it would work so incredibly on the dance floor that he was just kind of a bit obsessed with it. So that was the idea behind using Dave Sardy. Now, Dave Sardy had produced that song and the idea for Jet, and the idea was that we go out and we make our song sound like a bit like that, or have a similar effect to that, and we get a load of indie kids on the dance floor, and, you know, we sell a million records. Yeah. Obviously, that didn't happen, but it worked pretty well. You know, that record sounds good. And I can't remember why. I think maybe we didn't have the budget to do a full record with Dave, but what happened is that we were in a situation where we did half of it, I think six or seven tracks. I think we had six, and then we wrote The Enemy when we were out there, and we added it on and kicked another off, although I can't remember exactly what it was. Anyway, yeah, the idea was that Dave would produce six songs at fucking Sunset Sound in LA, you know, amazing world, you know, rock and roll history studio. And then we come back to Mogwai's Castle of Doom studio in Glasgow.
That was it, Castle of Doom.
Where Tony Doom would be like have to match the sound. And amazingly, he did, you know. So that was kind of that. But, you know, in terms of the writing and what led up to the recording process, that was... that, you know, as I said, we were in a tiny room in Alaska Street Studios in Waterloo, and we were there, I can't remember how long, maybe 3 months, just bashing songs out every single day and crafting the record and making plans and hanging out and, you know, being mates. And then we went off to LA to record with Sardi. So, yeah, that was that.
So I remember you saying someone recommended Tony Dugan. Was it Dirty Pretty Things?
I honestly can't remember, but it will have definitely had something to do with the fact that Alan had worked with him before, and we. But the other thing was as well, like we were just really, like you say, he worked with Mogwai, and we were kind of listening to that at the time as well. So it was like, it was like we were into some of the stuff that he'd already worked on. I didn't even realise that he'd worked with Delgados. Did he do that?
I'm wrong, but I think he did.
Right.
Because they always use that. Those Chemical Underground records were always made at a studio called Savat, and he was the house engineer there. That's what I think was the case, but I could be mistaken. Mm. Anyway, the reason why everyone was encouraged to use Castle of Doom and work with Tony Dugan, and Dugan's brilliant, don't get me wrong, but he really is actually. But the was that, you know, Mogwai owned Castle of Doom. So the more business Alan puts through Castle of Doom, maybe on a bit of a commission there. But it worked. It was good enough.
When we got there to record with them as well, you know, we were all well up for getting hammered, like, all the way through the session or whatever, like we did on the first record. And he was like, no, I'm sober, because apparently you guys had made him good. Apparently you guys had, you know, after working with you lot, he had to get sober.
I think he was trying to, and we weren't very helpful.
He's, I don't know if he's still sober now, but he was at the time. And we weren't allowed to drink in the studio.
Oh, God.
We had to go home and have a drink.
I think maybe we had that rule, and then, but we didn't have it for very long.
And then obviously you get to the point in 2008 where you call it a day on Dirty Pretty Things. And I saw... You said it'd run its course and Carl needed a bit of space. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the McGee story is the best one, where he goes, you know, this isn't sexy anymore. And he was right. It's so classic, you know, band heavily overindulge in extracurricular activities, band take fucking ages to make second record. I mean, it's not tricky, is it? And then by the time he made the record, and it's taken all that time, the public have moved on, or the scene's moved on, or, you know, the record company have, and the second record doesn't work. It's that is absolutely classic, and that's what happened.
Do you think that isn't sexy anymore? Do you think you could apply that to a lot of the scene, maybe?
I mean, this is the problem with the scene, isn't it? In that, you know, you when at its genesis and when it's at its peak, it feels like the most vibrant, vital thing going, and you feel like you're, you know, part of the future. 2 weeks later, you know, forget about it. It's scenes are by their nature fickle. You know, people move on. People are interested in different things.
And then, obviously, I think it's 2 years after that, or a year after that, Libertines got back together. Is that something you foresaw happening?
I wasn't too surprised. I think Carl did a couple of solo records between them, and he wrote a book. So, I mean, if Roger was doing that, that must have been, I don't know, 2015 they got back together?
I think it was like 2010, I thought it was.
No, it's much later than that.
Was it?
Maybe I've misremembered it.
Pretty sure they played 2010 Leeds Festival. 2010?
I, I just don't remember.
Well, you're right. They did play Leeds in 2010. It doesn't surprise me when they do that kind of thing because they make so much money off it. So, you know, whatever. If they can, and if, you know, Carl wouldn't do it if he and Gary wouldn't do it either. If it was too much of a pain in the ass, they'd just move past it. So, you know, any problems that they had the first time round are either better now, or, you know, the band are more philosophical about how they deal with them. Because Carl was quite draconian with Pete when they, you know, he was like, you're out of the band until you clean yourself up. And that was somewhat ironic, but it was, you know, he was really, he took quite a hard stance. And I guess McGee had a hand in that as well. So I don't know whether Pete's much, much better now, or the, you know, Carl and Gary just sort of care less and let him get on with his own thing. But whatever. I mean, it was funny at the start of lockdown. At the start of lockdown, we set up a quiz on via Zoom on, like, every Friday night, like a lot of people did. And there was about 10 of us on that quiz, me and my wife and Gary and Carl were on it as well, and a few other people who, you know, we were friends with back in the day. And I don't see Carl or Gary very much at all, but we're still friends. But we won this quiz, and after about 6 weeks, we had to, like, call time on the quiz because it got too indulgent, and everyone was just like, it wiped out everyone's Saturdays because we just stay up on Zoom like far, far too late, and then not be able to operate on the Saturday. And after six or eight weeks or something, we had to pull it. But, you know, that's how's that? Behavioral nonsense.
Yeah, I saw a quote from Carl about the end of the band where he said that he was too idealistic about it. Is that kind of related to what you said, where he wanted it to be like a massive band, basically?
I don't know what that means. What did he say? Like, he can't be the band anymore because he's too idealistic?
Barrett said that he was too idealistic about the band which he formed, but looked forward to having future friendships with his bandmates intact.
Yeah, I mean... I don't really know what that means, but whatever. But certainly the friendships are still intact. Across all, I know that Carl and Anthony particularly are still close, and you know, I saw Stan a few months ago. In fact, it was the second BLM rally, and then, you know, I see, you know, Carl and Gary and I are still in touch, and we text from time to time. But, you know, it's good. And the same with the Coopers, you know. I mean, I talk to Tom from the Coopers all the time. I had to pop something into Fisher the other day. Kieran was due to come round for Sunday lunch a few weeks ago before the London got raised to tier two or tier three or whatever it was. We're on good terms with everyone, I think.
The Cooper boys, are them lads still doing anything?
So... After the Coopers split up, Tom kind of did various things. One of the things was a band called, I can't remember what they were called, White Tag, Yellow Tail, I think they were called. And then he formed a band called Losers with Eddie Temple Morris and Paul Mullen from Your Codename Is Milo. But he also produces records. He now lives in Berlin, because of course he does. But he's still doing music. Fisher formed a band called... Red Kite, who have released a couple of records, but that's kind of a sideline thing. He works for Apple on Regent Street, actually. Kieran, I don't really quite understand what Kieran does, but it's something to do with archaeological history, and he's studying to be a professor. Ben does really well, but his job is like basically going into, he's like a corporate coaching of some kind. I don't really understand it. I don't really understand a lot of people's jobs. And Kieran have a thing. What are they called? They've got a band, and they've been working on their first album for about 12 years.
Right. Okay. is that ever going to get out?
No, of course not. Well, maybe it will. They've got some stuff, but they're called Type 2 Error. And then Gary and Carl, obviously, we know about. And Anthony runs off to LA, gets sober, and wins a fucking Oscar. So,
ooh. Yeah, saw that.
And I'm having friends with him about it a little bit. There's an element of people, of kind of insurrection there, where people feel like he's one of us. He's one, you know, he's a band guy. He should be playing at the guitar at the club. But he's penetrated the establishment hugely. And gone and infiltrated it right the way to the top. So, you know, that's Anthony.
What about you then? Have you carried on making music?
No, not at all. So I did a little... After the Dirty Things split up, I did a couple of bits of session work playing bass, but I wasn't really good enough to be a session player, as I found out. The one that really worked... incredibly well was playing bass for Brett Anderson. This was before Suede got back together, and he had I think he was on his third record. So I played bass for him, and we hit it off as mates and musically as well, and the band was really great. And then he made a rockier record, and he did another tour that I played on. I didn't play on the records, I just played live. And then in 2010, Suede got back together, and I'd started. I think I'd pop by the management office to hand in some passport photos for a visa application, and the woman that was looking after Brett at the time said, "You know, I'll give you £50 if you hang around the office and fill out everyone's visa applications." And I said, "Okay." Because, you know, I wasn't in a band anymore. I was DJing a bit. I was doing a bit of session work, but I was skint. And I sat there for the afternoon and I filled out the visa applications. And then for some reason, I came back the next day and the next day and the next day, and I'm still here. So, and that was, you know, 2010, 2011. And I've been working mostly on Suede, on the management side for, you know, the best part of 10 years. I also worked with Chrissy Hines, doing the same job. We did a band called Bad Breeding for a little while, a little punk band from Stevenage. So, yeah, I mean, but I haven't really played or had the motivation to play since then, really. And, this generally amazes people, but I don't miss it at all. But I'm, you know, I wouldn't change it for the world. So that's me.
Is there a high point of those days or any time in the band really did?
I think one of the main things, I think it's everything's best when you first do it. And I think when... there was a moment that I really remember when we were, in fact, two. One was when we were the Coopers Pen, the first Reading Festival, and me and Tom were driving, we were on the tour bus. Me and Tom, out of the skylights of the tour bus, driving into Reading on the IDR, shouting at each other and laughing because that was, you know, that was the whole point, playing Reading Festival. And there was a similar thing where we were driving across Tower Bridge, and listening to Steve Lamacq, and they played Devil Walks in the Sand on the Lamacq show. And, you know, that's a watershed moment as well. I mean, you know, going to Japan, going to the States, you know, all of these things, you know, incredible. The first time we went to Fuji Festival with the Coopers, amazing. Like,
I think you've already really answered it, Dids, but is there anything you would do differently about any of that time?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I've said, you know, there are things that I regret, like being too inebriated to be able to perform my function, but there are low points and struggles, but, you know, what on balance, you know, what dream come true, totally. Away, away, what happened today? The dancing walks in.